wife, Steve Farnsworth, from Alcoholic.
Hey, Steve Farnsworth.
Thank you for inviting me here tonight. Last time I was here, I spoke out in the, what's it called?
Pavilion.
I'm really glad that didn't happen tonight. And I'm also really grateful for microphones and speakers, because I tend to be very soft-spoken. And I just find it very difficult to try to carry a spiritual message at the top of my lungs. I don't know why I find that challenging.
Microphones help for people with hearing aids.
Okay.
Bless you.
Bless you, too. And I get it. And my sponsor, who has been passed away now for almost 4 years, but he's still very much alive and in this room, you know, teaching me lessons like you just did, and or, you know, with all your heart. And I felt that, but Tom told me for years that I need to speak up, and it's just not happening. But I'm doing the best I can, and so because I'll do it intentionally, and then within two or three sentences, I'm back to my normal tone, and I don't even realize I'm doing it. So feel free to throw some hands up or whatever if you need me to speak up. But I'm really grateful for the microphone. My sobriety date, June 18th, 1989. And I got that sobriety date while I was flying airplanes to the United States Navy, stationed in Brunswick, Maine. And they made it very clear to me in, you know, different words and different actions that you are going to continue to fly our airplanes, or you are going to continue to drink, but you're not going to do both. You're going to do one or the other. That is your choice. And I really wanted to keep flying airplanes. Fortunately, when I find something that I like, I know there's nobody else in the room like this, but when I find something that I enjoy that feels good, don't tell anybody, but I like to get excessive. Ouch. Anyways, and I really enjoy flying airplanes, and so that, you know, it was just another human power, a fetish, if you will. I have other fetishes that I'll spare you, but I used it. I used it to fill the emptiness in my soul, and I also used the drink as well as other behaviors. Sex was a big one, you know, of course, there's a lot of other substances. There are very, very few people that really grew up in any age, but definitely for me, like in the 70s. That weren't tempted to dabble at the very least, if not get excessive with a lot of those substances. And I only got excessive with the ones that were put in front of me, just so you know. I did try to control it a little bit. So anyways, my home group is Harbor City Speakers Meeting. It is a 1-hour speaker meeting. It meets in the Inner Harbor of Baltimore, Maryland. And it was my home group when I first met my sponsor at 7 years sober, when I was ready to put a bullet in my head as a result of 7 years of just going to meetings and not drinking, and having a sponsor by name, and expecting something to rub off just by coming to meetings. And in case you think I'm the only one talking this game, AA publishes a pamphlet called A Member's Eye View, and in that pamphlet, it says something along the lines of, if all you're doing is coming to these meetings and waiting for something to rub off, the only thing that rubs off is rigor mortis and death. And I did not get a copy of that pamphlet. I would not have been able to read it if I did, because I don't know about you, but I can get up here and read like an educated person, but I can't tell you what I just read, because I got committee meetings going on in my head that rarely let me get a word in, and very often they are screaming, like, who is this bozo up in the podium at this meeting that just drove 2.5 hours to, you know, lie to us, you know? And I promise you that I passed a lot of people along the way here today that I could have lied to. I didn't need to come here to find people to lie to. You know, I came here to basically bear witness, you know, to tell my brothers and my sisters, because they invited me, not because I felt like they needed to hear me, but because they invited me to tell them, to share with them my experience and the way I see things. And unfortunately, I've given some very straightforward instructions on how to do that most effectively, and that is to share in a general way, so I will not be dumping my creepy four-step on you. I'm sure I'm the only one that has a creepy four-step, except for the guy that was sponsored because I heard theirs. But anyways, in a general way, what I used to be like, how I got here and what happened, and what I've been like since. And honestly, that changes by the minute. It changes by the day. You know, one thing about Alcoholics Anonymous is it'll allow you to change your past, absolutely love your present, and help you to see your future. Right? And I don't know where else you can get that deal, to be honest with you. But my past that used to haunt me as a result of practicing these 12 steps on a daily basis, in other words, where most people are looking at these 12 steps like there's some kind of a process or hurdles that I need to go through and graduate through, I prefer to look at it more like guardrails. I actually prefer the word bumpers because guardrail sounds like a hard hit, and I think God has an incredible amount of forgiveness. But more like bumpers to kind of keep me on this path of awareness and or awakening, if you will. And the analogy that I like to use is if you brought your child to a park, you wouldn't chain him to the monkey bars. You might want to, but you're not going to. I'm sorry, thank you. But, you know, if you brought your kid to a park, you're not going to chain him to the monkey bars. You're not going to put him in a cage. You're going to let him run free and have fun. But because you're a loving parent, you're going to give him some parameters. Don't talk to strangers. Don't go too far where I can't see you. Play well with the other kids, right? And in my experience, that's pretty much what the 12 steps are. They're basically my loving parent, whatever that is, right? Telling you what I should and shouldn't do. And you know how I make it made aware of that is first off by love, hundreds of forms of love, including the promise of joy, the promise of peace and happiness and serenity and these kinds of things. But if I don't pay attention to that or somehow I get distracted from that, just like a good parent, then I'm going to get some fear. In other words, I'm going to get put in time out, you know? Either way, I'm going to pay attention. And either way, it's still a loving act. You know, when you discipline your child, it is still a loving act. And your child knows that if you really do have love in your heart. But, Diane, it's the same thing with my relationship to this power that I refer to as God. You know, when I'm being disciplined, you know, in other words, when I'm getting too far off course and I start feeling some fear in my heart, fortunately, I try to exercise this sixth sense of inspiration so that I know when it's coming, so I don't have to actually go and get myself in trouble. I can feel it coming. And anybody who's been addicted to anything knows that sixth sense. It's like, I know when I'm getting ready to cop, when I'm getting ready to, you know, get whatever it is that I'm looking for to fill this emptiness in my soul. I know it's coming, and I'm already getting relief and excitement, and I don't even have it in me yet. You know, that's the same. That's the sixth sense that we know very well. And we just try to exercise that with filling the emptiness in our soul with what I believe we were designed to use, which is helping others. The reason why I know that, and just for the record, helping others is most effectively done one-on-one, when nobody's looking, and from the heart, not the ego, and sharing my experience, not somebody else's. But the reason why I know, why I believe, that is what I'm supposed to be doing is because when I do it, it feels really good. And I get rewarded in many, many ways for doing it. When I don't do it, I don't feel so good. And I feel like the world's out to get me. It's the same reason why I know that I'm supposed to be eating food and drinking water and breathing air and finding shelter and getting rest. Because when I do it, I feel good. And when I don't feel good. It's the same reason why I know that we are put on this planet to reflect the love of God through helping others. And just for the record, I don't know what God is. I don't think I'm supposed to know what God is. I love that set aside prayer, and I absolutely felt the motion that you used when you said that. I believe that if whatever God is, if God wanted you and I to know, then we know, because that guy's got some serious control issues. He likes to do things his way. You know what I mean? And so I'm pretty sure that if we were supposed to know, we'd know. Add to the fact that people that think they know are notorious for starting wars with each other over who's right. You know? But I know that there is a God. The reason I know it is because I know the expression of God, which is love, in its hundreds of forms, respect and dignity and honesty and compassion, on and on and on. That's how I know there's a God. Just like I know each and every one of you have a brain, I have no idea what your brain looks like. I personally cannot point at the place in your head where your brain resides, but I can see the expression of it. And I also know there's electricity running through these walls because I can see the expression of it. But that is how I know, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that there is a power that we call God, because I can see the expression, which is love. I'm telling you, my belief right now, and I know I'm getting kind of pushy here, and I don't mean to because I'm supposed to be sharing my experience, but this is the way I see it. And I believe that there is only love. I don't believe that fear is real, but I believe it really feels real. It is just like darkness is not real, but it really feels real. But it really is just a lack of light. You know, light can penetrate dark, but dark cannot penetrate light. And love can penetrate fear, but fear cannot penetrate love, not real love. And so there's only love, and there's only light. And but there is the awareness of it and the lack of awareness of it. And these 12 steps and 12 traditions are designed to show me and you how to get aware in any given moment in time. Because with that awareness, now that I have that conscious contact, that conscious awareness, now I can execute my free will in harmony with these principles. And life becomes easy and fun. But I didn't know that growing up. What I knew growing up was something's wrong with me. I do not feel like I fit. I am obsessed with self. I will continue to obsess about myself and try to figure out what particular human attribute that I've been challenged with that is causing me to feel like I don't fit. And then I will find people on this planet that are dealing with that same particular human attribute, and I don't feel like I fit in with them either. I fake it. That's the best I can do. And I pray to God, because it is such a deep, long, empty darkness, and I just pray that one day the mothership will land and say, Steve, come with us. We made a big mistake. We put you on the wrong planet. We're going to bring you to a place where you fit. Because I could be in a room full of biologic clones of Steve Farnsworth and still feel like there's something different about me. And but you put a drink in me, or a particular drug that does the trick, or some good sex, or whatever, the game is on. I'm in. Matter of fact, I fit so well, you really want to get away from me. And I don't even need to speak the same language you're speaking. I don't even need to be in the same culture that, you know, that I was raised in, and I will fit. That's what the drink did for me. You know, and when I say drink, I mean all the other things that I can replace the drink with. But the drink allowed me to walk comfortably in my own skin for the first time in my life. And I like to equate it to people that have had like traumatic events, like maybe their house burned down or something. For a long time thereafter, everything that you talk about is, well, that was before the fire or after the fire. And my experience with my first drink, which happened about 11 years old, was everything in my life was basically before the drink and after the drink. And then eventually, once I got sober and got exposed to these 12 steps in a very loving way, everything in my recovery was either before the 12 steps or after the 12 steps. Because I came here under the illusion that drinking was my problem. And I'm assuring you right now that drinking was a problem. I have thrown up on perfect strangers, right? My favorite one was I was at a rock concert with psychedelic lights going on, and it was like, and so I was like, and I was tripping, so I could see tracers of my vomit going on this absolutely beautiful, beautiful woman with this long black hair, and I remember seeing her with tracers going. That was my favorite one, but it wasn't the only one. So, the point that I'm trying to make is I don't drink well. I am a man. Anybody who watches me when I am drinking would say that there's a guy who should not be drinking, right? But the problem is that most people that can see everything on the outside but can't see what's going on the inside, they would say, he's a good guy. He comes from a good family. He's got a good education. He's got a hotshot Navy pilot career. He's got a house, a wife, and car, and a truck, and a motorcycle, and all the trappings of life, right, for 26, 20, whatever age I was. They would say, if he just didn't drink, he'd be okay. But what they don't know is what's going on the inside. And when the Navy put me in rehab and took the drink away from me, the best way I can describe it is there was this traffic choke point in that every morning I'd go to work and I'd sit there, and it was to go across this road that was alongside of a dam, a big water dam. And I would sit there in the traffic and daydream, and I would look at this water dam, and I would see the water kind of, you know, dripping through these rocks, and I'm like, man, that would be crazy if that thing just burst open right now, right? But I used to think, like, that's like my life right now. It's like liquor is the only thing that is holding my life together. It's what allows me to be okay with my wife. It's what allows me to figure out a way to, you know, get my bills paid or do for the Navy what they need me to do, although I wasn't doing any of those things very well, but I was okay with what I was doing. It allowed me to be okay. And now you're taking away the glue, and my life's going to come crashing down. And I knew it in my soul, and I was right. The night before I went to rehab, I told my mother, and I have been a mother's boy my whole life, and I will be till the day either her or I leave, and even then after probably an eternity. And I'm not apologizing for that. She's one of the most beautiful human beings on the planet. But anyways, I remember telling her the night before I went to rehab, and she was 4 months sober at the time too. But anyway, I said to her, Ma, I got a lot of problems in my life, and drinking is the only relief that I have for my problems, and now they want to take that away from me too. I'm trying to figure out who they are, right? But is it because it's anybody but me? Is basically what that is. And I didn't realize how close I was to the truth at that point in time. Not that they were the problem, but that drinking was my solution. Drinking was my relief. And, you know, you take a bone away from a dog, you better offer him a steak. Otherwise, eventually he's going back to the bone. You know? And the bone was all my little, you know, my drinking and whatever else I was using for human powers to fill this emptiness in my soul. You know, these people that could see the outside, they were taking that away from me because it looked like that made sense. Like, you can't drink. Stop it. Right? But they weren't replacing it with any kind of a steak. And what happened was I was empty. And what happened was the glue got removed and my life did come crashing down. Because I didn't know how to live anymore. I didn't know I've listened to a lot. I've been sober 27 years now, and I've listened to a lot of fifth steps, and I've watched a lot of people and tried to help a lot of people. And I compare the bottoms, you know, that people experienced, you know, the depths that people had to go before they got sober. And I often think, look, you know, compare it to my own, and I'm like, I never went down that far when I was drinking. I probably would have, you know, just by looking around at whatever happens to everybody else that continues. But I guess I got stopped because of the Navy, you know, just because of circumstances, whatever. I went to rehab, and a bunch of things came together at the same time. One of them was I was absolutely disgusted with myself. I don't know about you guys, but alcohol rehab was not on my career plan. And I was not looking forward to throwing this on my resume, you know. I knew that a lot of people in my family, I was hearing about this hereditary thing, and I knew a lot of people in my family had drinking problems, and the one thing I could identify with each person in my family was that everybody else in the family could see that they had a problem, but they couldn't see it in themselves. And it was enough of an open mind for me to consider the possibility that maybe if I can't see it, or just the fact that I can't see it in myself, you know, I might be having the same problem, okay, where everybody else can see it, but I can't see it. And so that made sense to me. I told this intake counselor at rehab some answers to his questions, and I honestly believed them. A few days after being detoxed, I remembered that those were lies. But they were lies that I had told so often that I forgot that they were lies. I started believing them myself. And so now my own thinking's credibility was in question. And so I developed a healthy respect for liquor. And I knew there were people on the planet that could drink safely, and I'm just not one of them, and I accepted that it's okay. You know what I mean? It's just, you know, I just don't get to drink. Okay. It didn't necessarily stop the mental obsession, necessarily. You know, the physical allergy was, you know, I went through a detox and that got my attention. I didn't even know it was like a detox. I thought it was more just, I'm just full of fear and you guys are going to figure me out that I'm a phony. I thought that's why I was shaken. The ability of the mind to rationalize is amazing. But to give you an idea of the mental obsession, I went to a 6-week rehab, and about 2 weeks after being back, so I was about 2 months sober, I had a lot of drunk dreams, but this one particular night, I was dreaming that I got my life together, and my wife came back, and the Navy was off my back, and the creditors were off my back, and everything was cool, and everything was great, and my reaction to everything in my life being good was, I should be able to have a drink in safety now, right? And so I went down to my refrigerator, and I got myself a perfectly chilled beer. And I remember everything about getting out of bed. The decision was made. I was feeling good about this. Walking down the stairs, open up the refrigerator. The bright lights are shining because Hark the Herald Angels Sing, and you can hear the music. And I pulled this beer out, and I remember the weight. I remember the chill, the dew, the pitch. You know, I remember everything about it. Taking the drink, it was the best drink I ever had, asleep or awake. Let's just put it that way. It was so good, I had to go get the second, of course. But now, I'm in my dream and I'm thinking, I'm like, oh shit, I blew my sobriety. I blew my 2 months. And that was a big deal to me. And it should have been a big deal to me. But then the next thought was, I'm not going to tell anybody. I'm going to keep this a secret, right? Because it's none of their business. And so that was my decision. And then I saw the AA people come running. Like the Gestapo, right? They're running after me in my dream. So have you ever seen a dog running in his sleep? That was me in my bed. And just to kind of put a time frame on it, it was in a waterbed. That's how old I was. But anyways, I'm running in my sleep, right, from these AA people because I don't want them to know that I drank. And then I woke up. And I'm like, okay, cool. It's just a dream. Had a million of them. And then I looked over at my nightstand, and there was 2 empty Michelob bottles in Puddles of Dew. I'm like, oh man, it wasn't a dream. And then I woke up again. So in other words, I dreamt that I was waking up from a drunk dream. That gives you an idea of the mental condition that I have surrounding these things. And so just more reason for me to have a healthy respect for liquor. I would picture skull and crossbones on the bottles. You know, like, these people can drink, I can't, I'm good. And so, but the problem was, is I heard this, you know, if you just go to meetings and not drink, you'll be fine. Well, I was just going to meetings and I didn't want to drink, but I can't focus, I can't concentrate, I have no direction. I don't know that real alcoholism has nothing to do with liquor, it has to do with this spiritual condition that I have, this malady, this feeling of separation and disconnect, this thing that, you know, from inside I don't want to be outside, upstairs I want to be downstairs. I can't get okay in my own skin, and it feels like I have to work 20 times harder than the average guy to get half the distance, and I always make one stupid move, and I rip the carpet right off from underneath everything that I just built, and I'm starting at ground zero again, and I got doctors telling me that I lack willpower. And I'm like, I don't think so. You know, I've, you know, destroyed and rebuilt my life 3 times over, and I'm 28. I don't think willpower is the problem. You tell me there's a drink on the North Pole, you will see me at the North Pole if I want a drink. You know, willpower is not my problem. But, so I have this condition, this malady, that really doesn't have much to do with the drink, although if I am drinking, I'm not going to be able to get to the solution, but because of the physical allergy and the mental obsession, so abstinence from liquor is absolutely necessary, but it's not the problem. It was a problem, but it's not the problem. The problem is the way I see the world when I'm stone cold sober. The problem is that I have this yearning in my soul that if I don't fill it on a regular basis with helping others, I will fill it with other things. Worldly human powers. And there's nothing wrong with a lot of these human powers. There's nothing wrong with having a wife or a girlfriend or children or, you know, a career or nice things. You know, it's kind of like, it's like when you're hungry, it's okay to have a car, but don't eat it. You know? But the car's not meant to be eaten. And so there's nothing wrong with having a family, and there's nothing wrong with having these nice things that money can buy, and the careers and the educations, but don't use them to fill the emptiness in your soul. They're not designed for that purpose. But I can't keep walking around empty, so I got to get tapped into a power bigger, and that's this power that I call God, which is really just the power of love. And but I needed direction to figure this out, because I could, I wasn't hearing that. I was sizing the world up around me with no direction. I was basically isolated in my own little world, you know, which is basically residing right here between my ears. And it was telling me that if I got all these nice things, I'd be okay. But it's like, how many times am I going to try that and fail before I realize that I'm barking up the wrong tree? And but I couldn't see that. But that's called insanity, just in case anybody wonders. And so I got to get tapped into this power, and I didn't know how to do it, and I was just lost. And so I'm going through Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm destroying every good thing in my life. My wife left, the house got, you know, repoed, not foreclosed on, my truck got repoed. The Navy said, we've done everything we can, Steve, we don't know what else to do, you got to go. And they gave me an honorable, but it was involuntary. And they let me go on the reserves for a little bit. But so now I get this big severance paycheck. 30 years old, not even, like 29 years old, about a year sober. And most normal people, when they lose their marriage and lose their house and lose their vehicle and lose their career, they would be devastated. But I am not a normal person. My reaction to all that is, I'm free. I thought I owned all that stuff, and in hindsight, what I found out is that all that stuff owned me, because I was using it to fill the emptiness in my soul, and everything in my life depended upon that. It was my God. You know, the church is calling them false gods, false idols. It's like, who cares what you call them? Human powers, the things of the world that I'm trying to use these tools improperly. Didn't know it though. So I kept running with it. So now I'm living in Maine, and Maine's the problem. Maine's kind of backwards, right, in my mind, right? And so I'm like, okay, I gotta go, right? So I don't know about you guys, but I'm a real big fan of free rent, and so I run home to Mom. Mom happens to be living in Baltimore. I did not really have a draw to Baltimore, but I had a draw to the free rent, and so I moved to Baltimore. A few months in, my mom's like, okay, enough, you need to go. And keep in mind, I'm sober. Going to meetings, just not drinking, right? And I'm a winner, right? All evidence aside. And got this woman to let me move into this house that she was trying to sell, because it was like a crack house. And the deal was I could live there for free if I fixed it up. Problem is I get real obsessed with, you know, coffee and staying up all night, and I'm fixing this thing up so well that I sold it right up underneath myself. And I'm back to being, you know, like homeless, basically. But it was in Maryland for a while. Then I went to California to try to get discovered. I got discovered, but not for the things I was trying to get discovered for. And and then came back, went to Maine for a bit because the house had to go and I had to clean it up. And that means take everything out of it of value that I can sell. But anyways, I ran out of ideas and money in Boston, Massachusetts. And the only thing I had was a very well-exercised body, obviously not anymore, but way back then. And I had a, you know, kind heart, although as long as I didn't open my mouth, I was probably somewhat attractive. But as soon as I started talking, I repelled people. I picked up a nice little sex addiction. And if you're young, halfway decent looking, I guess, nice, and you have a sex addiction and you really want to get the job done, I suggest moving to Boston. Boston's got like 60-something universities of, you know, do rotations of, you know, meat puppets of hormones every semester, and you just kind of run through it and tear it up and get the job done. That's my report to you. However, I also want to report to you that was the darkest existence of my life. You know, I don't know about you guys, but when you get excessive and you find yourself with someone, and then when you're done, they are talking, and you start realizing that they know that you've been together before and you have no recollection of it. That's how sick it was. That's how bad it was. Taking something really beautiful and using it for something really ugly. So I knew my behaviors were, you know, risky, so I was trying to protect myself, and I ended up catching a virus anyways because I took a risk too many, and I wish I could hit the lottery that way, but whatever. I hit it, and doctor says, you're going to die soon, and my reaction is, all right, how do you look concerned? Because he's going to think something's wrong with me, because honestly, death looked like relief at that point in time. I was 6 years sober when that happened, just going to meetings and not drinking. And just for the record, a year later, I met my sponsor and started helping others. The virus went undetectable, and the doctor died. So the doctors don't get the last word. As I said, in his defense, I'm not glad he died, but in his defense, had I continued on that path, I'd be with him. But I remember when I told my sponsor that this virus went undetectable, he's like, "You had your say. Your doctor had his say, the world had their say, but God gets the last word, and God hasn't spoken yet." So anyways, it's amazing what the immune system can do if you are treating your spiritual condition. So anyways, I didn't know that yet, though. There was still a year to go, a year of complete darkness, and then that year before I met my sponsor, now I'm infectious, and now I'm hurting other people, and I can't stop the behavior, and I just want to open up a vein. And I'm going to the psych ward, and I'm telling them that I need to be locked up because I am a detriment to society. And they're weird about locking people up that are begging to get locked up. I don't know why. So instead, what they just try to do is medicate you, and at least that's what they did to me. And I know there's a lot of people that need those medications, but I'm telling you right now, I did not. I was trying to treat a spiritual condition with a synthetic solution that was keeping me from getting to the spiritual condition. And so it was a bad move for me, but please do not. I think there are people that need them, and I support you. So, anyways, so that was the condition I met my sponsor in, and I was 7 years sober. The amount of respect I had for Alcoholics Anonymous caused me to refer to it as a dog and pony show. That's what I said to my sponsor. I've been coming to this dog and pony show for 7 years, and I've never heard anybody talk about AA the way you just did. He talked about God like he was his buddy that he was hanging out with on a regular basis. He talked about the big book like it had a heartbeat. And he talked about being sober like it was fun. None of that was my experience. And so I followed him. And I did what I always did in AA, which is try to play monkey see, monkey do. You know, if you said something good, I would go to another meeting and parrot it. And I basically got the life of a parrot. I got to live in a cage. Because I wasn't sharing from my heart. I was sharing from your lips is what I was sharing it over. So anyways, I brought this kid with me one night to hang out with my sponsor, and we're in the car, and we're getting in the car, and you know, Tom would say something, and then I would say something, and Tom would say something, and I would say something, and then Tom would say, "Steve, shut up. We don't want what you have." It's like, sit down and just shut up. Now, I don't know about you guys, but I can have like multiple committee meetings going on at the same time. One of them was like, "I don't know who this old man thinks he's talking to," right? The other one was like, "Thank God, because I just thought you wanted me to say something, right? You know, thanks for, I thought I was obligated, right?" And I thought something you guys would think something was wrong with me if I didn't throw my 2 cents in there. But the kicker was when he said, he goes, "We don't want what you have." And I shut up and I could hear for 2 seconds because I wasn't talking. And he goes, "You don't even want what you have." I'm like, "Oh yeah, I forgot about that." And so I just shut up. And I just got in the car and just let him do all the talking. And we went everywhere you can imagine. We were going all over the place. And just supporting each other and looking for new guys and new girls to help. And I was watching him. I was hoping he'd screw up early. But what happened was I was in this meeting in East Baltimore, and it was a big meeting. It was a smoky meeting. They had this machine up in the ceiling to suck the smoke out, but really all it did is absolutely ensured you weren't going to hear the speaker because of the noise of the thing. But I watched Tom across the room, and I couldn't hear the words, but I could see the body language. And there was a woman that walked in that looked like death warmed over. She looked like she'd been wearing the same jacket for like 50 years. It was a fire hazard. She was staring at the ground like I would, you know. And uh, the kind of woman today that I would just want to kidnap and just take her home to let her know that it's going to be okay. And I don't know what Tom said to her across the room, but I watched hope come into her body language from across the room. And I knew two things in that moment. One, I seriously missed something at Alcoholics Anonymous in my first 7 years. And two, that whatever just happened over there, I really want to have a taste of that before I check out, because remember, I still think I'm dying at this time. And so now I knew there was something that, I didn't have that delusion that I tried AA and it doesn't work. I knew right then and there that I had not tried this. And so I started following Tom around, and then he said one day, there's a guy over shaking at the coffee pot, and he said, go tell that guy what you do to stay sober and happy about it, but for God's sakes, don't tell him what you think. And I'm like, I think I was just insulted, but anyways, I said, Tom, you know I'm a train wreck, right? And you know that I'm not qualified to help him. And he says, I know you're not qualified, and you know you're not qualified, but he doesn't know you're not qualified. Just get over there. And I said, what do I say when I get over there? He says, God will tell you when you get there. And I'm like, God doesn't run around with me like he runs around with you, you know? He said, why can't I know now? He says, because you'll F it up between here and there. Just get over there. And what I found out is that when you get eye to eye, windows of the soul with somebody, and you genuinely really want to help, stuff will come out of my heart and across my lips, and my first thought will be, wow, that sounded good. I need to remember that, right? But the truth is I don't want to remember it, because the next time it won't be from my heart. It'll be from my intellect. And that's where this little issue that I have resides. The solution's in my heart. And so anyway, I just told Gary, the guy at the coffee pot, I said, that old man over there wants me to help you, and I don't have a clue how to do that. I'd appreciate it if you can make it look like I'm helping you. And Gary and I laughed, and we started talking, and we started running around, and my heart started coming alive because I was helping him, and I had no clue what I was doing. But I was, God does not use the qualified. He uses the willing. And so I showed up, and I wasn't afraid to say, I don't know when I don't know. And I was just saying, I said, I got a lot of experience with what doesn't work. I can share that with you. And so I just started doing this stuff, and the next thing I know, I got a second person to help, and then a third, and then a fourth, and next thing I know, I got the peanut gallery of AA. Right? Steve, you can't sponsor that many people. You can't sponsor girls. You can't sponsor people out of your geographic area. You can't. I'm like, well, what can I do? Sit around and be miserable like you? Because I don't want what you have, and I don't even know who you are. And I'm having fun, and these guys are having a good time, and they're coming alive for the first time in AA, and their parents think I'm the second coming of Jesus right now, and I'm having a really good time. And so if you don't like it, call the AA police on me. It's like, oh yeah, we don't have any. And the reason we don't have any AA police is because we don't need them. Because if the spiritual consequences isn't bad enough and painful enough to get you to change your behavior, we drink. Long before any police activity could get us. We got the bottle to keep us in line, and the other forms that the bottle takes. And so I just started running around, and next thing I know, I'm moving up to York, Pennsylvania, because there's a ton of recovery houses up there. It wasn't my plan. I happened to sponsor this woman that had some control issues herself, and when she decides that something's going to happen, you just kind of go for the ride. And I ended up moving to York and lived there for about 4 years. Fell victim to the delusion that if I'm helping people, that it's okay to be irresponsible, particularly with my finances, that God will provide, right? But irresponsible behavior is irresponsible behavior, regardless of where your heart is. And so I ended up losing everything again. Pretty much everything I had got sold for crack on Queen Street. And then when I left there, the only thing I had was this mentally, physically handicapped old man that I kind of adopted. He got in my car for the weekend, and that weekend is about 11 or 12 years in running right now. And we have this joke of saying, I said that I was praying for God to put somebody special in my life. I guess I should have been more specific. But after I moved back to Maryland and got, you know, kind of regrouped, and then I ended up moving to Massachusetts to do some more houses, which my sponsor kept telling me. He's like, Steve, these yahoos have more petty problems than you have money or time. And I'm like, nah, I can do it, right? Like, 4 years later, both times, so I don't learn real easy, I come back, I'm like, man, those yahoos have more petty problems than I have money or time. But anyways, so this one time I'm up in Massachusetts, right? And I'm telling you, it was challenging, it was busy, but there was a lot of love going on, and I'm still, you know, reaping the benefits of that because my heart was in the right place, even though it was some irresponsible behaviors. But my buddy John, the old man that I take care of, he fell on the ice and had to go to rehab because he cracked his hip and stuff, physical rehab. And I remember one day I just got so overwhelmed. I said, you know what? Screw it. I'm turning my phone off, locking my door. I'm just going to go take John out so he can have a cigarette. And I put him in a wheelchair, and he reads body language really well, like a kid. And he goes, Steve, what's wrong? And I said, I'm all right, buddy. I'm just a little overwhelmed. He goes, you want me to be your sponsor? And I said, John, you have no idea how much you're my sponsor right now. He just keeps it real for me, you know. Mm-hmm. And there is not a word in the English language that can just describe the love I have for that old man. And so we don't always get what we need. I mean, we don't always get what we want. But in that particular case, I definitely got what I needed. And so anyways, I also got a chance to take care of my sponsor. My sponsor came down with Alzheimer's in like 2010, and we brought him up to Amherst, Massachusetts, where he had his houses, and I had a lot of help taking care of him, and it was a really beautiful experience because all these people, even in the midst of their drug addictions and their other, afflictions, they had a lot of gratitude for the fact that this old man put 32-something years worth of his life consistently and excessively into helping others, into serving God. And I was just telling Anthony this a minute before the meeting, but to give you an idea of the power of that, there's a woman in Baltimore named Blanche who's been sober like for 50 years. And back in the day, when she was getting sober, they would give us electroshock therapy treatments. And she said she had so many of those treatments that when she came out, she did not know her name, didn't recognize her husband, had no idea where she was or where she lived, but she remembered what she drank and where she drank it. It was the only thing that stayed, the one thing they were trying to eradicate. And it reminded me of that when my sponsor was in the midst of his Alzheimer's. He couldn't tell you where he was, what he was doing, who people were that he knew for a long time. But you get him talking about spiritual principles, and he was on point every single time, even in the midst of his Alzheimer's. And one of the most powerful ones, I don't know if anybody's experienced somebody with Alzheimer's, but they have good days and bad days, right? And he was having this particularly bad day one day where he was just zoned. He's just in la-la land. And I had a friend of mine come visit from, or a friend of both Tom's and I, came to visit Tom from California, and he had a limited amount of time, so we decided we were going to visit him anyways, even though he really couldn't, you know, participate in conversation or anything like that. So we're just feeding him. So he's facing us. Andrew and I are facing him. And in the back, what happened was this chaplain brought this, he came in to give everybody kind of like an uplift to all these other Alzheimer's patients. He brought them in, circled them up in all their wheelchairs, and just trying to give them a little uplift. And he knew that one of the things with these people is that they really wanted to leave and go to church, but they couldn't because of their medical condition. And so he told this story, and he said that there's a New York City taxi cab driver. The moral of the story was that your church can be anywhere. You don't have to go to a real church to go to church. And he said, there's this taxi cab driver in New York City that believes his cab is his church. And his mission is if you get into his cab, his mission is that when you leave, you feel a little bit better. And Tom, who hadn't moved pretty much the whole day or said anything or even moved his eyes, he looks over at me and he goes, and then he went right back out into La La Land. That's how deep these spiritual principles are. You know, they can break the electroshock therapy treatments, and they can also break Alzheimer's even for a second. You know? And I was telling, that was another story I was telling about John, the old man who was under the belief that he was helping this guy get into a tub. This guy was detoxing off methadone, and he just wanted to get in a hot tub because his bones hurt or whatever. John wasn't really helping, but he thought he was helping, right? And when he stood up from helping the guy get into the tub, he had this moment of clarity because of that selfless act. And the thing that the kicker was, he knew that I saw it. And it blew his mind that not only that he had it, but that there was a witness. And then he went right back out. He's like, I got to smoke. But my point is that selfless act even allowed John, who's born with, he was born with alcohol fetal, that's what his problem is. And, but, he's been retarded, I know it's a bad word, but whatever, mentally handicapped, whatever, who cares. But his whole life, you have a little moment of clarity, And sometimes I think, that I might not be helping John very much, but he's helping me a lot. And if I'm not doing anybody else a favor in my heart, and you tell me I'm delusional if you want, I don't care, but it's real to me. But there's a woman who, back in the 50s, suffered from alcoholism, untreated, and couldn't stop drinking while she was, was pregnant with this kid. And I can't imagine how she must have felt when she gave birth to this kid who was physically and mentally handicapped because she couldn't stop drinking. And she ended up dying from her alcoholism when John was like 9 or 10 years old. And maybe I'm just making an amends to her. Not necessarily that like I caused any harm, but maybe, we missed a shot. We missed a shot at helping this one person, this one soul, whose, heart had been breaking, after, not being able to stay sober during his pregnancy. So I don't know. Maybe I'm just, too, soap operaish or something, but it fits right in my heart. So my sponsor Tom passed, and I had to make the decision to let him go because we had signed papers years before. It was easy to sign the papers, not so easy to make the decision. But Tom found ways to assure me that that I was making the right decision, and so did a lot of other people that helped me. And on Tom's deathbed, he used to tell me a story that this friend of his showed him how to live and he showed him how to die, and that's exactly what Tom did for me. But on Tom's deathbed, he was a womanizer, by the way, and there was this one woman that used to come visit her mother in the Alzheimer's unit all the time, and so anyway, she walked by and she's like, what happened? He was doing so well just a couple of days ago. He had fallen and broke his hip and got septus or something like that. It's a blood pressure. And I told her about it. She goes, oh, he's such a sweet man. And I said, no, he's a son of a bitch. Right? And now Tom's in his oxygen mask and he's like, ha, 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 ha. He's like laughing, right? And she's looking at me like, are you kidding me? Did you just call him that, really? And she knew we were in AA. And I said, well, Tom used to always say that everybody in my home group has a job. And my job is to be the DSB. That's the designated son of a bitch. And what his job is when people try to bring garbage into my group, that basically means anything that's not spiritual in nature. He goes, my job is to take the garbage out. I said, right, Tom? And Tom's like, you got to take the garbage out. And those are pretty much his last coherent words before he died that evening, early that morning. But he showed me how to die with dignity is what he did. He showed me how to live with dignity, and he showed me how to die with dignity. And I got a lot of help burying him because his insurance didn't pay, and we gave him a really nice plot. I got some control issues of my own. I bought the two plots next to him to make sure Patty Burke and I could spend eternity with him, right? But I remember coming back into Baltimore, moving back to Baltimore after we got Tom buried, and it was, 96 to 2013, so I guess that's 17 years, right? That I was with him, and I remember driving into Baltimore and going, man, what just happened? What was that? And I'm not talking about his death more than I'm talking about this, those 17 years. How did I go from being told I'm going to die and being grateful for it, hoping it would come soon, to the last 17 years and now here? And the only thing I could think of, like, what just happened was, now that was a trip, because I used to do a lot of LSD. Right? I'm like, no, that was a trip. And then all I could think about after that was what the Big Book promises, which is a rocket ship ride. And that was definitely a rocket ship ride. And it hasn't ended. I came back to Baltimore after being gone for 3+ years. And to my surprise, everybody in Baltimore didn't stand still. They changed. The people in the meetings changed. Some of the meetings changed themselves. You know, there was people doing fine without me. And so it was almost kind of like coming back to a new area and having to basically start all over again to kind of cultivate my little sphere of service, or church, if you will, right? Like the chaplain at that Alzheimer's unit said. And so I got my hands in this mission that we have in Baltimore. It's really nice. It's a sweet mission. It's not like a dirty mission like most cities. It's really nice. And we get my home group got basically handed off to me. Same with our ex recovery conference. And then this chip house thing fell on my lap. It's a house that's been around since 1960. The guy set it up for people who need help getting on their feet financially, who are serious about their recovery. And he set up the corporation in a way, because he's passed now, but he set it up in a way to where if it ever goes under, all the value of the home and its contents goes to the state, because he didn't want anybody to get involved for money. So everybody that's involved is in it because they want to help people. And that just fell on my lap. And so, and it's got some nostalgia in Baltimore AA too, so I take a lot of pride in that too, in trying to get this thing fixed up. And I still got my job. I've had the same job. Next year will be 20 years, although they did just lay me off recently, but that was temporary. But but my point is even when I left to go to York, they kept my desk there for me and let me do stuff remotely. Same thing when I went to Massachusetts, and then I came back. And it's only because I followed one simple direction that my sponsor said when I was nervous about screwing up this job opportunity. He said, "Steve, all you need to know is to show up on time consistently and follow directions. That's it." They're paying you because they want to tell you what to do. I'm like, I never would have come up with that on my own. Right? And so now I just show up on time consistently and I follow directions. And every day, you know, I'm like, today's the day they're going to figure out that I'm incompetent and tell me to hit the road. But that's been coming up on 20 years now and they haven't done that yet. But so maybe tomorrow, I don't know. But either way, my actions and my stories haven't made it very clear. The one thing I need to make clear with you before I shut up is that I'm having a lot of fun in Alcoholics Anonymous. I feel God, and I see God, and I feel like I walk with Him to the best of my ability, even though I don't know what He is, and I don't want to know what He is because I don't think He wants me to know what He is. Right? What's the thing? How do you do that? There it is. So beautiful. It's real. It's not a fairy tale. You ever if you can picture this, it's like, you know, the fear of God would be like to stand in awe. And the best way I can relate it is like if you took a kid and you set him loose in a grocery store, and the kid's just running through the aisles, just having a ball, being a clown, laughing and having fun, and all of a sudden he haphazardly stumbles across the candy aisle, and he's like, whoa. Shit just got real. You know? That's the way I see God. And I try to do it as often as possible. And momentum and become second nature. And I do it today on a fairly regular basis, more by default, because I have not stopped. You know, and I have people tell me, why don't you take a break? Because I don't like hurting. I don't like the way I feel when I stop. But the big book does have a heartbeat, and there is genuine hope available in what we do, and we can't keep it if we don't share it with you. So if you're not feeling it, you're doing us a favor by allowing us to share it with you. You're saving our lives by allowing us to share it with you. So please don't feel afraid to come up and ask for help, because we thrive on that. We thrive on helping you. And there's real hope available here, and I guess I'm out of time, so I'm going to shut up. But thank you very much.